We commit our ways to you and ask that you would be with us as we study this afternoon. Amen. Okay, we are in Baha Alotcha, when you set up. It's Numbers chapters 8 through 12, and as has been typical of our journey through these portions, we don't get very far past the first few verses of the portion itself, and it won't be different today either, I'm afraid. The Lord said to Moses, "Speak to Aaron and say to him, when you set up the lamps, see that all seven light up the area in front of the lampstand." So Aaron did so, and he set up the lamps so that they faced forward on the lampstand, just as the Lord commanded Moses. This is how the lampstand was made. It was made of hammered gold, from its base to its blossoms. And notice it says here too, like with the tabernacle generally, the lampstand was made exactly like the pattern the Lord had shown Moses. Now, one of the interesting things about the lampstand has to do with the fact that it doesn't have any dimensions in the text. Much of the furniture in the tabernacle, as the Lord speaks to Moses and he is instructed how to build what, often the dimensions of the various pieces of furniture are included in the text, but not with the lampstand, which is kind of an interesting phenomenon. But Moses is told to make it exactly like the pattern the Lord had shown him. So, apparently, the Lord showed Moses the lampstand of the heavenly tabernacle and tells him to make the one for the earthly tabernacle exactly like that one. At any rate, there are several midrashim that will talk about this afternoon. The first one is in Numbers Rabbah on this section, obviously. The Holy One, blessed be He. By the way, notice that the reference to Numbers Rabbah, this is chapter 15, paragraph 2, but it corresponds with Numbers chapter 8, verse 1. So, the designation in the Midrash doesn't necessarily coincide with the designation in the text itself, right? In other words, this portion, Baha Alotcha, begins in Numbers Rabbah 15. At any rate, the Holy One, blessed be He, said to Moses, It is not because I require lamps that I have reminded you about them, but only in order that Israel may acquire merit. For it says, the light dwells with him, with God, obviously, a quote from Daniel 2. And it is written, even the darkness is not too dark for you, but the night shines as the day, the darkness is even as the light, from this passage in the Psalms. All this serves to teach you that He, God, does not need the lamps of mortals. There is proof that this is so. And then, this is an interesting phenomenon with regard to the construction of the temple. Okay? When a man builds a house, he makes in it windows that are narrow on the outside and broad within, so that light may enter from the outside and illuminate the interior. Solomon, however, who built the temple, did not do it in this manner, but made windows that were narrow on the inside and broad on the outside, so that the light might go forth from the temple and shine outside, or shine outwardly. Okay? As it says, as for the king's house, he made windows broad within and narrow without. But there is an issue with the translation. They were open towards the outside. If you look at your note, the windows were open towards the outside but closed towards the inside, which is what the Hebrew words shikufim asumim mean in this passage in 1 Kings chapter 6. Okay? At any rate, what's interesting about it is that in the temple and in the tabernacle, both, there were two chambers, right? The holy place and the holy of holies. The lampstand was in the holy place. So in the lampstand, as it was burning, it provided light for the holy place so that the priests could function and perform their service in that area. But in the Holy of Holies, there was no light. And there was a big, thick curtain that separated the Holy of Holies from the holy place. Now, what's interesting is that the temple had windows all the way around, or at least on the north and south sides. But the windows were designed not so that light would go in to the temple, but that light would come out. Even from the Holy of Holies, which had no light in it, except, of course, for the light that was created by God's presence. Okay? This is an important idea. The light that was created by God's presence. This first passage from the Talmud, Menachot 86b, refers to the shape of the windows. So we'll go down to the next Midrash, having to do with this same idea, from Leviticus Rabbah and from Numbers Rabbah. Another comment. A mortal lights a lamp from another lamp that is already kindled. Can he possibly light a lamp out of darkness? No, right? I mean, if you go into a home or into a place where a candle is burning, you can take another candle and kindle your candle from the one that is already burning, right? But if there is no candle burning, then you can't kindle your candle, right? You have to strike a match or in some way initiate the burning process, okay? But of God it is said, and darkness was on the face of the deep, followed immediately by, and God said, let there be light. If out of darkness I brought forth light, do I require your light? I only told you to kindle lamps in order to elevate you, to continually to elevate you through the lamp. In other words, God provides his people with an ability to do what he has called us to do, which is what the statement in the earlier Midrash means, that God provides us the principles that make it possible for us to be elevated through their observance. Okay? Now, this Midrash from the Pasikta Rabbati also speaks about God's light. We just talked about this Midrash on Thursday evening. It's a collection of Agadic Midrash, or homilies, on the Torah and the Haftorah readings and the special Sabbaths, okay? But this is a 9th century Midrash that is very interesting, specifically because of some of its insights regarding the role of the Messiah. So, from Pasikta Rabbati, in your light do we see light? A quote from Psalm 36. What light is it that the congregation of Israel looks for as from a watchtower? And then it notice references here, it is the light of the Messiah. Now what's interesting is it says that what we've read so far indicate the fact that humans are not a source of light, but God is. God is a source of light. We have the capacity, like the moon, vis-a-vis the sun, to reflect God's light, right? But it doesn't start with us. It is a function of the indwelling presence of the Shekhinah, of God's Spirit. Okay? So, what we've noticed so far is that in the tabernacle and in the temple, both, the holy place had no natural light. Light didn't come in to the inside of the tabernacle in the temple, right? It radiated from the inside out. Except, of course, in the holy place, which is where the menorah was standing. Obviously, the oil burning in the menorah did provide light. But in the rabbinic material and in the biblical text, the rabbis understand it to mean that God is a source of light because he can kindle a lamp even when there is no other source of natural light, right? But according to the sages in this midrash, that also happens to be the capacity of the Messiah as well, okay? It is the light of the Messiah of which it is said, and God saw the light when it was good. So, according to this midrash, when God saw the light and he saw that it was good, it was a reference to the light of the Messiah. This verse proves that the Holy One foresaw the generation of the Messiah and his works, notice, before the world was created, and then stored it away under his throne of glory for the Messiah until the time of the generation in which he is to appear. So, as this midrash goes on, it says, Satan asked the Holy One, Master of the universe, for whom is this light that is stored away under your throne of glory, right? Who are you storing this light under your throne of glory? Who is it for? God replied, for him who will turn you back and put you to utter shame. Satan said, Master of the universe, show him to me. You know, please show him to me. God replies, come and see him. Now the moment he saw him, Satan was shaken. He fell down upon his face and said, surely this is the Messiah who will cast into Gehenna both me and all the heavenly counterparts of the princes of the earth's nations. Right? So it's an interesting dialogue that takes place, but one that emphasizes the nature of the Messiah, which, of course, is something that's emphasized in John's Gospel. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to testify concerning that light, so that through him all might believe. Of course, it says of John that he was not the light. He only came as a witness to the light. But then in verse 9 it says, the true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. Okay? It's obviously a reference to Yeshua. He was in the world. And notice this, though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. And then the parallel statement, he came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Right? So, even though the world was made through the Messiah, the nations of the world do not recognize him as the Messiah. And even though he comes to his own people do not recognize him as the Messiah either. Okay? Yet to him who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. And it's an interesting statement because it is made in the context of the fact that the true light is the one who gives light to everyone coming into the world. So it makes the Messiah as God a source or the source of light, which is something Yeshua reiterates in John chapter 8. After the incident with the woman who was allegedly caught in the act of adultery. Yeshua says to her after everything is said and done, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but have the light of life, right? And of course, this passage in John 9 expresses a similar idea, where Yeshua says in verse 5, while I am in the world, I am the light of the world. This is an interesting passage. This is the one where Yeshua spits into some mud and mixes it up and then applies it to the eyes of the blind man, as opposed to just reaching out, touching him, and healing him. Okay? At any rate, let's move on to another midrash, another observation about this particular paragraph. Another exposition of the expression, when you lightest. This bears on the scriptural text, even the darkness is not too dark for you, but the night shines as the day. The darkness is even as the light. Yet to us he says, when you light it, right? To what may this be compared? To the case of a king who had a friend. The king said to him, I want you to know that I shall dine with you. Go then and make preparations for me. So his friend went and prepared a common couch, a common candlestick, and a common table. When the king arrived there, came with him ministers who encompassed him on this side and that, and a golden candlestick preceded him. His friend, seeing all this pomp, felt ashamed and put away all that he had prepared for him, as it was all common. Said the king to him, did I not tell you that I would dine with you? Why did you not prepare anything for me? So his friend answered him and said, beholding all of the pomp that accompanied you, he said, I felt ashamed and put away all that I had prepared for you because they were common utensils. By your life, quotes the king to him, I shall discard all the utensils that I have brought, and for love of you, I shall use none but yours. So is our case. The Holy One, blessed be He, is all light, as it says, and the light dwells with Him. And yet He said to Israel, prepare for me a candlestick and lamps. Okay? This is an interesting story, because it talks about just how valuable are the things we bring to the table, right? The things that we bring to our relationship with God. And even though God is surrounded by light, even though God is surrounded by glory, and His glory is such that it isn't even possible for us to look upon it, right? We still have the capacity to bring things to Him and to express our love to Him, regardless of in what way, you know, we bring it. I hope that makes sense. What do we find written in this connection? Let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. And thou shalt make a candlestick of pure gold. When they had completed everything, the Shekhinah came. What is written in that connection? Moses was not able to enter into the tent of meeting because the glory filled the tabernacle. Thereupon he called to Moses, as it says, the Lord called to Moses, as it is written, when Moses went into the tent of meeting that he might speak with them, then he heard the voice speaking. What did he say to him? Excuse me. When you light the lamps. This reminded me of a story that I have always enjoyed very much. The boy who crowed like a rooster and saved a city. Okay? Once during the Ne'ilah prayer, the word Ne'ilah means locked. On Yom Kippur in the synagogue, there is a whole series of services. Okay? The morning service, there's a memorial service, there's an afternoon service. At the end of the day, just before we break the fast together, there is one last service called Ne'ilah, and it's the final service of the day in the synagogue for Yom Kippur. The Baal Shem Tov, who lived in the 17th and 18th centuries, is regarded as the founder of Hasidic Judaism. At any rate, once during the Ne'ilah prayer, the Baal Shem Tov cried and entreated more than he did usually. The disciples understood that there was a great prosecution above, and the situation was grave. You're familiar with the significance of Yom Kippur and the fact that during the 10 days of awe, God makes judgments regarding what takes place in the coming year, right? And so it is a very serious time of reflection and introspection and recommitting one's life to the Lord, right? So it involves all of these kinds of things. At any rate, the disciples understood that there was a great prosecution above and the situation was grave. And they also intensified their prayers and crying as well. When the rest of the congregation saw this, their hearts were shattered, and they also joined the impassioned supplication. There was a young man there from a village who had come for the days of awe, the 10 days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, to the Baal Shem Tov synagogue. He was completely uneducated. And he stood the whole time looking at the face of the cantor without saying anything. As a village dweller, the boy knew the sounds made by all of the different farm animals, and he especially esteemed the rooster's crowing. When he heard the weeping and the outcries, his heart was also shattered, and he cried out loudly, "Cock-a-doodle-doo! God have mercy!" The worshippers in the synagogue were confused to hear a voice crowing like a rooster. And a few of them scolded him to quiet him down and would have thrown him out of the synagogue if he had not protested, "But I am also a Jew." The confusion was pierced by the voice of the Baal Shem Tov, followed by the disciples as they hurried to finish the Ne'ilah prayer. The face of the Baal Shem Tov shone, and with a special melody, the repetition of the Amidah commenced for the Ne'ilah prayer. As Yom Kippur ended, the Baal Shem Tov related to his disciples that there had been an accusation leveled in heaven, with the prosecution seeking to have a particular community sentenced to destruction. Of course, the prosecution is Hasatan, the accuser, right? At any rate, as he aroused divine mercy on the community, a great prosecution was aroused against him for encouraging Jews to settle in villages and out-of-the-way places where they were likely to be influenced by their Gentile neighbors. When he began to examine the behavior of the village dwellers, he saw that the situation was very grave. However, suddenly the sound of the call of the village dweller was heard in heaven, the cock-a-doodle-doo, and its sincerity brought great pleasure above, nullifying all the prosecutions, right? So this is a sweet story. It's contained in a work called Igrot Kodesh, the Holy Epistles, or the or the letters of the Rebbe, but it communicates a very simple concept or idea, right? That even though God is clothed in glory, we have the capacity to please Him with things that are very simple. Simple, but genuine. Simple, but heartfelt, right? And that is really a key to approaching God, to coming into His presence. It's a key that energizes prayer. It makes our relationship with God function in the way that it intended. And it kind of reminds me a little of two paintings that my grandson did for me while he was here a month ago. One of the things that he did, his mother got out some paints for him. And so he had a couple of pieces of paper and he painted something for his Saba, his grandfather, right? And, you know, I mean, to look at them, you know, they are not great works of art. He's 2.5, right? But to me, they're great works of art, right? Because he painted them with his typical energy and joy, and these pieces of art are things that I'll keep with me always, right? Because they reflect who he is at a particular age and our relationship with each other, right? And I think that's the kind of the idea that is intended, that's the idea whose expression is intended in this story about the uneducated village individual who attends services. But there are passages in the apostolic writings that speak to this concept or idea too, like this passage in Colossians 3, verse 17, whatever you do, whether in word or deed, do it all in the name of the Lord Yeshua, giving thanks to God the Father through Him. Which, by the way, doesn't mean to say in Jesus' name at the end of everything you do. It means to do it with the understanding that Yeshua is the one who facilitates our connection to God, right? So, it applies to everything we do. Everything we do should be done with a great deal of, heart and intention and recognition that the Messiah is the one who facilitates our connection to God. And later on in the same chapter, Paul writes, whatever you do, work at it with all of your heart as working for the Lord, right? Not for human masters, but working for the Lord. Okay, let's move on because there's still a few things to discuss. You can already tell that I'm not going to make it, but that's okay. One of these years I will learn not to include so much. At any rate, when you set up the lamp, see that all seven light up the area. Okay? So according to the sages, this is to teach us that the lamplighter must hold the flame to the wick until the flame arises on its own accord. Have you ever tried to light a candle, but you didn't hold the match to it quite long enough for the wick to actually catch on fire? Right? It's like you wave the match past the wick, and you expect somehow the fire to jump from the match to the candle, right? But of course it doesn't. So the match goes out and the candle goes out, right? I mean, we've probably all done that. But it's true whether you are lighting a candle or building a fire, for example, right? If when you are camping, you know, fires, they require a certain effort, right? But you don't stop lighting the fire until the fire is burning without your assistance, right? You don't stop holding the flame of a match to the wick of a candle until you're sure that the candle is burning on its own without the match, right? So your job is to kindle the candle or to light the lamp, but it requires a certain investment because you have to make sure that it's kindled and has the capacity to burn by itself. Okay? This is to teach us that the lamplighter must hold the flame to the wick until a flame arises of its own accord, according to Rashi. The spiritual significance of the mitzvah of lighting the menorah is that one should be a lamplighter who ignites that latent potential within the soul of man, the lamp of God, right? So in other words, just as the priests are called to light the menorah in the tabernacle and in the temple, so too are we called to ignite that latent potential in the soul of others, right? But as you can see, this requires an effort. It's not simply a matter of speaking to a stranger. It requires investing yourself in the lives of others. Here too, the endeavor must be to kindle the lamp so that a flame arises of its own accord. In teaching and influencing one's fellow, the objective should be to establish him or her as a self-sufficient luminary to assist in developing his talents and abilities so that his lamp independently glows and in turn kindles the potential in others, right? So of course, I think you can probably guess where this is going in terms of the way discipleship works. The concept of discipleship comes from this idea. So, as we read in Matthew 28, right, when Yeshua is addressing his disciples, he says to them, "Go and make disciples of all nations, teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you." Right? It requires an investment in the lives of those that you are connected to. Right? Sharing the gospel, Mark's account, unfortunately, has been the gospel that the emphasis in terms of what it means to share the gospel is based on, when it should be what Matthew says, what Yeshua says in the gospel of Matthew, right? Because people think that sharing the gospel is presenting a concept in a supermarket line, right? Or leading someone to pray, the sinner's prayer. Or in whatever that providing a testimony. However that works. But Yeshua didn't say, he didn't say, tell a story or confront someone with this concept or idea. He said, make disciples. And the idea of making disciples comes from this midrash regarding making sure that when you light a lamp, that the lamp has the capacity to burn independently of your influence, right? That's what discipleship is all about. The Jewish Rav, teacher, Yeshua, devoted himself to fulfilling the great commission of his day, raise up many disciples. This is a comment from Pirkei Avot, chapter 1, paragraph 1. It was a common idea or notion in the first century. Yeshua was just reiterating it. And whereas the rabbis often applied it to members of the Jewish community, in other words, the rabbis are teaching their disciples to make disciples of the members of the Jewish community, and of course, those Gentiles who have a heart for the truth, but Yeshua, you know, applies the notion of discipleship very broadly to include all nations. Why? Because just as the Torah is not just for Israel, but for the nations as well, so is the concept of discipleship. It's for everyone. At any rate, this author, Dwight Pryor, you may be familiar with him, said, "This prime directive has flown as the banner of the sages since the time of Ezra. Its inspiration, however, may be found in the very nature of the Torah and the character of the giver of the Torah, the God of Israel, the teacher of Israel. Out of his abounding grace, his chesed, his loving kindness, he gave to Israel the Torah," right? Out of his chesed, his abounding grace, or his abounding love, his abounding kindness. The word chesed is a difficult Hebrew word to translate. He gave Israel the Torah, the guidance and direction of a loving father teaching his children. At Sinai, the Lord came down in glory and taught his disciple Moses the words of life in the Torah. And frankly, we should understand the manifestation of Yeshua in much the same way. Just as God appears to Moses in a physical form and teaches him Torah, so Yeshua appears to us. God appears to us, or to his disciples in the first century, to his people Israel, in a physical form as well. Right? It is very similar. At any rate, this passage from Avot de Rabbi Natan, this is the Pirkei Avot, the commentary of Rabbi Natan, he talks about the fact that the school of Shammai says, a man is to teach only one who is wise, humble, of good stock, and rich. But the school of Hillel says, Hillel was more lenient than was Shammai, every man is to be taught. For there were many transgressors in Israel who were attracted to the study of Torah, and out of them sprang righteous, pious, and worthy men. What parable may illustrate the matter? The one of a woman who sets a hen to brood on eggs. Out of many eggs, she may hatch only a few chicks, but out of a few eggs, possibly not even one. So the idea is that you seek to raise up disciples from as many people as possible, because you really never know in what way your effort on their behalf will blossom or flower, right? There were several sages. One would not have thought or imagined that they would have become great sages, right, at the earliest stages of their calling, right? But as a result of the investment that was made in them by others and their own heart for God, they, of course, flower and blossom and become great influences on behalf of God's kingdom. At any rate, there are a couple of other statements regarding discipleship. If you can look at those on your own, that would be great. One from the Talmud, from Shabbat 118b, and another from another tractate of the Talmud, Ta'anit, the tractate on fast days. At any rate, let's look at number four. Racing on, I'm sorry. This is how the lampstand was made, exactly like the pattern the Lord had shown Moses. And of course, that is something reiterated in Exodus chapter 25. But what's interesting is that according to the scripture, the temple was built in much the same way. When in 1 Chronicles 28, David gives Solomon, his son Solomon, the plans for the portico of the temple, its buildings, its storerooms, its upper parts, its inner rooms, and the place of atonement, right? And notice in verse 12, he gave him the plans of all the Spirit had put in his mind, right? So, we don't typically think of the temple in quite the same way as we do the tabernacle, but according to this passage in Chronicles, David received plans regarding the construction of the temple from God, because the Spirit put these ideas, these dimensions and drawings into, and of course in Hebrew it doesn't say his mind, put it into his heart. And then David gives these plans to his son Solomon with the instructions that he make the temple exactly like these plans represent it. All this David said, I have in writing as a result of the Lord's hand upon me. And he enabled me to understand all the details of the plan. So, even though David did not build the temple, David is the one who received the instructions for how it should be built, in the same way Moses receives instructions for how the tabernacle should be built. Okay? Now, this notion or idea of pattern is an important one. Right, I mentioned in the note that I send out on Friday afternoons, I mentioned that we would discuss the pattern paradigm in Scripture. Notice there are several passages that speak of this paradigm. Luke in the book of Acts writes, "Our ancestors had the tabernacle of the covenant law with them in the wilderness. It had been made as God directed Moses according to the pattern he had seen," right? But what does Paul say about the pattern in Romans chapter 5? "Therefore, just as sin entered the world through one man, and death through sin, and in this way death came to all people because all sinned. To be sure, sin was in the world before the law was given, but sin is not charged against anyone's account where there is no law, or where someone has no obligation to observe the law," right? Or cannot be held accountable because he is too young, for example. This is where the idea comes from in Judaism regarding the age of accountability, right? That until someone reaches the age of accountability, they are not accountable to God for their sin. When they do reach the age of accountability, then of course they are, right? But Paul goes on to say, "Nevertheless, death reigned from the time of Adam to the time of Moses, even over those who did not sin by breaking a commandment, as did Adam." Notice who is a pattern of the one to come. So, just as sin enters the world through one man, it is also removed through one man, right? And just as we all die because of our sin, in the Messiah we all live because of His faithfulness. Right? So you can see the antithetical connections between Adam and Yeshua, between the death that He passes on to all of His descendants and the life that we experience in the Messiah. But this pattern is not just mentioned in the apostolic literature. It's mentioned here in this rabbinic midrash from the book of Genesis. Rabbi Berakiah said in the name of Rabbi Samuel Bar Nachman, though all lived through all living things, such as white figs, came into being in the fullness of their growth, notice they shriveled up as soon as Adam sinned, and will not return to their perfection until a scion of Perez, the Messiah, comes. Now we've talked about this many times, right? When God created the world, it was good. But when Adam and Eve sinned, something changed. The character of creation changed. Certainly, the character of life on this earth changes, right? Death is introduced into life for the first time. Sin and the consequences of sin and disobedience is introduced into the world for the first time. And frankly, the rest of the Bible is a history of the toll that death takes on mankind and the consequences that men and women experience as a result of their disobedience, right? And this is not just true for God's people Israel, but it's true of what the Bible teaches about the Gentiles too, right? Because the Gentiles are obviously accountable to the Torah as well. Not to all the same commandments or instructions, but certainly the one against idolatry, which is a commandment that the nations, certainly prior to the coming of the Messiah, but even to this day, that is a commandment which is completely violated. Maybe not here in the United States, but in many other places all over the world, the nations worship many gods, right? So this notion is compelling, right? What happens when Adam dies? Things shriveled. Their nature and character changes, right? But who will it be who restores nature and restores this world to its previous state? Previous state? And obviously it's the Messiah, right? So for the rabbis, there is a pattern paradigm as well that is identical to the one that Paul talks about in his letter to the Romans, right? But the rabbis, they prove it by using the spelling of the word toldot. We've talked about this before. In English, the word toldot is T-O-L-D-O-T, right? The two O's in that spelling in Hebrew are consonants that sometimes serve as vowels. But the word toldot means the same thing if it is spelled T-O-L-D-O-T, and it's pronounced the same way if it's spelled T-L-D-T, right? If you remove the vowels, the consonants which serve as vowels, it's still pronounced toldot, T-L-D-T, because the O's are understood. That's the way the word is pronounced. So it's pronounced toldot if it's spelled T-L-D-T or T-O-L-D-O-T or T-L-D-O-T or T-O-L-D-T. Do you understand me? It's a little confusing if you're not familiar with the way Hebrew works, but the point is, the word toldot is mentioned many times in the Bible, but there are only two occasions when it is spelled out completely, with all of the consonants and the two vavs that serve as vowels. Okay? The first time it is spelled out completely is when it is when in the book of Genesis we read about the generations of the heaven and the earth immediately after God created them, right? Because in the beginning, after God created the heavens and the earth, he looked at everything he created and he said it was very good, right? Creation is good. But every time the generation of a person is mentioned, the word toldot, used in the Genesis passage of the generations of the heaven and the earth, is always spelled defectively. It is always spelled without one of its two vavs, and in some cases without either vav, right? Until it gets to the generations of Perez. In the Genesis story, the Genesis story having to do with Judah and Tamar, because Perez was their child, right? When it gets to the generations of Perez, it spells the word generations completely again. And the rabbis deduce from this that it will be through Perez that the Messiah comes, the one who will restore the broken down order of the universe and of creation to the place that it once was, right? So it will be in the Messiah that the earth and all of God's creation is restored to its former glory. Okay? At any rate, this idea of a pattern is an important concept or idea because it makes it possible for us to appreciate something that is going on through what might be considered an obscure reference in a text, right? Just like Paul does in Romans when he says, as a result of Adam's sin, the earth he passes on from his generation to the next a fallen world, right? But in the Messiah, that fallen world is restored. Okay? It is because of Adam that death reigns in life. But in the Messiah, life reigns over death, right? The Messiah restores to creation what was lost as a result of Adam and Eve's fall. Okay? But of course, this idea is communicated in the way the Hebrew word toldot is spelled, right? There is theology in the way Hebrew words are spelled. Okay? It's an important concept. It makes the study of Hebrew very compelling because we are looking beyond the words of a text into the spelling of the words themselves, right? So it's like uncovering a secondary and tertiary layer of meaning in a text beyond what the text says on the surface. At any rate, the author of Hebrews also refers to this pattern when he speaks of the priesthood in Hebrews chapter 8. Okay? So, Let me just mention a couple of other things, because we are pretty much out of time. In chapter 8, verse 7, to purify them, do this. Sprinkle the water of cleansing on them, then have them shave their whole bodies and wash their clothes, and so purify themselves, right? This talks about the consecration of the priests, the shedding of the blood of the sacrifice that was offered on their behalf, their immersion in a mikvah, the cleansing of their bodies, the cleansing of their clothes, so as to purify them and make them fit for God's service. Okay? So the author of Hebrews says in chapter 9, when everything in the tabernacle had been properly arranged, the priests entered regularly into the outer court to carry on their ministry. But only the high priest entered the inner room, and that only once a year, and never without blood. He enters on Yom Kippur, which he offered for himself and for the sins the people had committed in ignorance. The Holy Spirit was showing by this the way into the most holy place had not yet been disclosed as long as the first tabernacle was still functioning. Okay? But notice what the author goes on to say. This is an illustration for the present time. Had the author of Hebrews not said this, it would still be a midrash. But he comes out and says what he's about to say next is a midrash. This is an illustration for the present time. Okay? In other words, when the author says that the way to the Olam Haba is not fully, was not fully declassified or not fully revealed, right, in the way it should be or would be in the future, because the blood of bulls and goats that were offered at the earthly tabernacle don't facilitate life in the Olam Haba. They don't make it possible to experience life in the Olam Haba. They do work to cleanse sin from the worshiper on earth, right? But they don't facilitate life in the Olam Haba. Okay? So the author of Hebrews tells us that what occurs at the tabernacle is like an illustration for the present time, and it is something that facilitates our understanding of what Messiah accomplishes on our behalf. But of course, what he accomplishes on our behalf is accomplished at the heavenly tabernacle, not the earthly tabernacle, right? And of course, the earthly tabernacle is a pattern of what transpires in heaven. Okay? So, this notion of Midrash is very important in the book of Hebrews. At any rate, I'm going to stop here and ask that you would, please read through the last of your notes. And I'll ask if there are any comments or questions. Ed offered a Shabbat Shalom to everyone earlier, as did Wayne. Are there any other comments or observations on today's study? Tina has a question, but in your notes, you also will see that the priests had hands laid on them to consecrate them for the ministry before they start, which is identical to the laying on of hands that we experience in the apostolic writings too. Okay, Tina, go ahead.
Hi, Rabbi. I just wanted to say that the when you were describing the candlelight and the discipleship and how, we're there to just the whole description of the candlelight and the disciples, it was really impactful for me.
Oh, thank you.
It's not just reading, you know, reading a passage in the Bible to get someone, you know, to bring them closer to God, but it's to really invest and, you know, invest in the person. And that actually does take a lot of time.
It does.
So it's, you know, it's not as easy as here's a pamphlet. It's like, you got to invest and build a friendship and a relationship with someone, you know, and see their, I guess, their light go off. So I just wanted to comment that that was really, helpful.
Thank you. I appreciate it. But one of the things, though, that Tina mentioned that is really important is that here you read a passage in the book of Leviticus, and I don't know how many of you have had the occasion to read the book of Leviticus, just to sit down and read it, but it isn't like a compelling mystery novel, right? No one would consider the book of Leviticus a page-turner. But the fact of the matter is a simple statement like the responsibility the priests have not only to kindle the lamp, but in Hebrew the words mean to make sure it's burning, right? That's the idea. You know, don't just wave a match in front of it, make sure it's burning. The ability that the sages have, the rabbis have, to glean concepts and ideas from such a simple statement, you know, to glean life lessons from such a simple statement, in my opinion, is very, very important. You know, their insight and capacity with the language really makes the study of the Torah so compelling, so interesting, right? So this idea is a very good one. Thanks, Tina. Charlene has a comment. Charlene writes, thank you for the additional comments about discipleship and what that means. I am understanding more and more the comment that everyone needs a rabbi. Right? Everyone needs a rabbi, including rabbis. Rabbis need rabbis. Right? Right? And, you know, but what's interesting is that in the Jewish community, you often... this is something I don't often hear, or didn't often hear, but in a synagogue, it is not uncommon for a rabbi to share an insight or something he appreciates another rabbi teaching him, right? I mean, it's at the service this morning, the rabbi mentioned this, right? He mentioned an insight that a rabbi he respects greatly, provided him, and still provides him. So it's an important concept that a rabbi should always be a disciple, and a disciple can also teach, right? So rabbis and disciples are interchangeable terms in Jewish thought, right? Very good. Okay, thank you, Charlene. I think there might be another. Cassandra expresses appreciation. Thank you, Cassandra, for your kind words, and Wanda for your kind words as well, and Ed for your kind words too. Thank you. So, any other comments or observations, or we can call it a day? Okay, very good. Then I will let you go. I will let you get back to whatever you have left of your Shabbat, and say thank you for participating this afternoon. Always a pleasure to see everyone, And I'll look forward to seeing you either Thursday night or next Shabbat. Okay? So, have a good afternoon. Enjoy the rest of your Sabbath and have a wonderful, wonderful week. God bless you guys. Litro.
Thank you, Rabbi.